Our next conversation starts in the fall of 1938 in Munich, Germany. The Nazis had rounded up thousands of Jews and sent them to concentration camps. A Jewish woman left her apartment carrying a painting. That painting played a key role in her family's escape from Nazi Germany. Now an exhibit at the Oregon Jewish Museum and Center for Holocaust Education commemorates the family's story. Joining me is Steven Engelberg. He's the editor of the news organization ProPublica. It was his grandmother who used the painting to escape. He's on the line from New York. Steven, welcome back to Think Out Loud.
Pleasure to be with you.
Before we get into your family's story, perhaps we could talk about the painting that was lost. Could you describe it?
Yes, although my account of it is necessarily at a remove. My father, who passed away about a year ago, told us all the story. And there was a painting that hung for my entire childhood in our living room by a German artist. And my father said that once there had been two very similar paintings, the one we had and the one that was missing. And the one that was missing, as you mentioned in the opening, had been traded for a visa, a crucial piece of paper that allowed my father's father to be released from the Dachau concentration camp and ultimately to make his way to America. And so none of us, of course, had ever seen this painting. My father last saw it in 1938, as you mentioned, Kristallnacht, which was November 9th, 1938. The Nazis rounded up Jews across Germany and, in fact, in Austria, and put many of them, the adult males, in camps. And, that was the last time, that month was the last time my father saw it. And so as you mentioned, I'm a journalist, and I had the opportunity to work with and to meet a German journalist. And I started saying, well, with modern social media, I wonder if one could find this missing painting that had so much to do with my family's escape from Germany.
So you didn't really even know what it looked like, I mean, other than what your dad had described?
Yeah, very general kind of picture. It was a picture of a woman, which we believe at this point was likely the artist's wife. The artist was a man named Stein, who, interestingly enough, had lived in the same small town that my family came from. It was a town called Chemnitz, Germany. And here a little bit of supposition, but we suppose that somehow he and my grandfather knew each other from the old days. Both end up in Munich, gave, we think, several paintings to our family. And again, this is a little bit of guesswork, but he did paint a number of portraits of his wife, and so perhaps that's what this was, but we're not really sure.
In the piece you wrote for ProPublica, you write that your grandmother leaves her Munich apartment carrying the painting. So where did she take it?
Well, just to back up even a little further, because sure. It's sort of interesting to think about the relevance to current period. A lot of people ask the question, why didn't the Jews of Germany leave? Surely they must have understood terrible things were happening. Why were they so complacent? And the answer is, first of all, many of them weren't complacent, but in the 1930s, during the Depression, there were very few places to go. And so what had happened is that in my family, shortly after the German government, run by Hitler, had passed laws sort of forbidding Jews from having employment and, doing business and so on, and this was in 1935, my father's father said, we've got to get out of here. Let's apply for a visa to the United States. And our immigration laws at the time were much, much more restrictive. And so the wait was 4 years. And in the fall of 1938, just before Kristallnacht, the American visas, long-awaited, finally came through. But the problem was that my father's father was not German. He was actually had been born in Poland, thus under American law, classed as a Polish national. So he had a longer wait. So the family was going to have to wait longer for that last visa to come in. It was during that period that the Germans rounded him up, put him in a concentration camp. And so the trick then was, okay, the Germans were willing to let go certain people if they had some place to go. But he didn't have any place to go. And so that day we're talking about, my father's mother decided to go to the Swiss embassy to try to get a temporary visa, a visa that would allow him to leave Germany, go to Switzerland, and wait till his permanent American visa came through. Without that piece of paper, of course, he would have stayed in German hands, but not have been able to leave Dachau or to leave the country.
So your grandmother was actually trying to get her husband out of the concentration camp.
Yes, exactly so. And, you know, we don't really know what happened. My father always said she never talked about it. What we know for certain is that she left with a painting and came back with a visa.
When did your family arrive in the U.S.?
My father and his sibling and his mother, I had a sister, came to the United States in early January of 39. And his father then went to Switzerland, where he lived for about 6 months, and then the American visa did come through just before the war broke out, and he came from Switzerland to America and joined the family in the summer of 1939. And, of course, the war breaks out on September 1st, 1939, so all in all, a very close call.
And they settled in New Jersey.
Well, they settled initially in New Jersey, and then, of course, as so many Jewish Americans in that period did, immigrants, they went to Brooklyn, Flatbush, which was then a very kind of down-at-the-mouth immigrant community. Today, very, very fashionable area. Here at ProPublica, many of our employees live in the neighborhood that my father used to describe to me with sort of a little bit of fear and concern. Today, it's extremely fashionable.
Wow. When your family arrived, they had with them a second painting by this artist, Otto Stein, similar to the one that was used to secure the visa. And you write in the piece that your father called this second painting his Mona Lisa. Would you tell us just kind of about the
Sure.
significance of it to your family?
Well, I mean, it was always it was both itself a kind of a sort of fun, you know, she is not quite exactly a Da Vinci, I would say. I'm not an art critic, but I would say it's probably a few cuts below that. But it is a portrait of a woman who's who has a kind of enigmatic smile and whose eyes do seem to follow you around the room a bit. And, you know, for us, it was always a sort of tangible sort of memory of this other piece of canvas and paint that was, in essence, traded for all of our good fortune of being in America. You know, and so, you know, there it was. It was just a very tangible reminder of you know, an escape from a very a dire circumstance to a place that was much better for all of us. You know, but again, we never knew what the other one looked like.
And where did it hang in your house? I think you said the living room?
It was always in the living room. My dad put it over in the most central position, and it had, always had a little light on it, and it was... you know, it's probably one of my most predominant sort of childhood memories. It was just always there looking at us.
Did you talk about it as a family?
From time to time. I mean, certainly we over time we sort of understood the story and learned about it. You know, I became, frankly, in later years more fascinated by this as I began to put the pieces together. The business about applying for the visa and so on came from my father's sister and my aunt. I didn't learn that until very recently. And then I really began, you know, as a sort of journalist and a thinker about, you know, events and investigations to say, well, wait a minute, now, how did all this happen? And you know, we actually did with the German reporters who got onto this, and they were, you know, they were going all over the country, and they did a kind of ongoing radio podcast about it. It was really quite fascinating. We went to great lengths to try to figure out, as I initially suspected, that the Swiss embassy in Munich was giving or selling visas to desperate Jews, and could we track down who signed the visa and, you know, what was he like and how many visas did they issue? And we did all this kind of investigative reporting. Unfortunately, I have to tell you, it didn't lead us anywhere particularly interesting. There was not an outlandish number of visas, and the person who signed that visa, he died, but the wife was actually alive until just a couple of years ago, but she had died. So we were never able to get to the bottom of what that transaction involved or what the Swiss embassy was doing. But, you know, people were very desperate at that period in history. And obviously they held a life-saving piece of paper that they could grant if they so desired.
It seems remarkable that your grandfather, Jacob, was actually released from a concentration camp to leave Germany on the Swiss visa. Was that common?
You know, as far as I can understand it, it certainly wasn't common because most people didn't have any place to go. But remember, in the sort of pre-war period, Dachau is not a death camp. It was a place where they would collect people in very, very dire, horrible conditions. In fact, one of the things that did sadly happen, my father's father died of a cerebral hemorrhage about a year after he came to the United States. And the German government ultimately paid compensation because he, as many of the prisoners were beaten by the guards. They're beaten on the head, and the German government acknowledged responsibility for his death. So it certainly wasn't a pleasant place, but it was not a death camp. And I think probably history would reflect that, you know, most of the men who were rounded up the night of Kristallnacht, November 9th, 1938, probably ultimately were released, only later to be sort of deported and taken away to the death camps, which were places like Auschwitz in Poland and such like.
You describe, I think, what is called the Night of Broken Glass. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah. And what was that for folks that don't know? I mean,
Yeah, absolutely. So it was a real moment where I think for the first time the world fully understood what Nazism was about, because what had happened was that a obviously mentally ill a Polish Jewish guy in France had killed a German diplomat, and the Germans had been waiting for a pretext to go out and do what they then did, which was sort of mob violence against Jewish businesses, Jewish schools, synagogues. And so across Germany, towns, Jewish businesses were set on fire. So my father has a memory of seeing the Munich synagogue burning and being warned to not go to school that day. And in fact, actually, he and his mother, after his father was taken away, hid on the grounds of the Polish embassy, because remember, the family was Polish, and that was considered to be international territory. And they actually slept outdoors for two nights before they dared go back to their apartment. So this was a real moment of mob violence and killing to some extent, but, you know, real sort of showing of what the future might bring. And at this point, at that point, from there forward, no doubts about what was going to happen, next to the Jews in Germany, which would be quite bad. It was called Kristallnacht. Both people, say various things about this. It was a very cold night, so it was icy. Also, the night of the broken glass, they were breaking the windows of Jewish shops and terrorizing people who lived in these towns who were Jewish.
And so it's in that context that your family's trying to leave Germany. I mean, did your father reflect on that time often as you were growing up?
Yes. I mean, I think he – and it's interesting, to think about that in the context of today. You know, he was very much conscious of being a refugee in the sense of having, as I think all refugees do, a sort of very comfortable – secure existence, understand who you are, the language you speak, the place you live, and then you're ripped out of that. And the level of sort of discomfort and sort of unease that sort of, I think, lasts forever in a person that has that experience. When we talk today, about, shutting down the refugee, not allowing refugees in the United States, you need to be aware, I think, of these are the kinds of people we're saying no to. And the vast majority of refugees who come to a country like the United States, even like my father, who learned English perfectly, became an English professor, even though he didn't speak a word of it until the age of 11.
Wow.
They never forget the experience that they had.
You told this story to a German journalist, kind of fast forwarding to today, who mm-hmm. was spending some time at ProPublica. Did you imagine he would make it his mission to find the long-lost painting?
Well, certainly not when we first talked about it. This guy was working here. We have an ongoing, fascinating program with Germany, where they send annually a sort of fellow who spends 3 months with us at ProPublica. We've had one every summer. And I have to say they've all been magnificently talented young journalists, all of whom have done interesting stories. This particular guy, Christian Solewski, was very talented, and we got to be friends. And I was just telling him this story about, my family's background and how fascinating it was. And, then we were coming up on the 50th, anniversary of Kristallnacht. I'm sorry, 60th. And he said, let's see what we could do here. I wonder if we could find this. And it was, very much in the air at the time, this sort of ability of doing journalism where you can talk to readers and involve them in a mystery. That was really a very new idea several years ago. And he was very excited to try it in Germany. He's an incredibly entrepreneurial fellow. He writes, he does audio, he does video, and he got some friends together, and they went out and, really turned this into a kind of a thing where the people were really enlisted to try to help be detectives. And this ultimately did lead them to a painting that may be indeed the one that was there. It's the one that's hanging at the Portland Jewish Museum. Provided to us, when they identified this painting, the person who owned it decided that he wanted to give it back to us, even though, again, I should hastily add that we are not certain to this day whether it is or it isn't. It's very difficult to know. My father was shown that painting, and he kind of said, wow, it sure feels like it could be, but I can't be certain.
So I want to ask you just a little bit about, the efforts that these German journalists took to track down what may be this painting that's on display in Portland now. I mean, just some of the specifics, like what, you know, how did they go about their reporting? It sounded like a large kind of national effort involving lots of different types of storytelling.
Yes, they was really fascinating. I mean, they got a little car that actually had the name. They were calling it Art Hunt, and it was on the side of it. And they made these podcasts and these videos that they put up on YouTube, and it really got a very sort of active interest among the listeners and viewers there. And they went to all kinds of events. There were some funny coincidences. One of the first funny coincidences is that when we started all this, we were not exactly sure who the artist was. You really couldn't read his signature in the painting that we have. And so, as it happens, Christian, the guy who worked with us at ProPublica, mm-hmm. he had a relative who was a specialist, a scholar in German art of the early 20th century. And so she had software, and we provided her with a very good picture of it, and she put it through the software and then did her own analysis and concluded that is Otto Stein. And once we knew that, we looked at the signature on the painting, and for those who go see this in Portland, they'll see this. If you look very closely and squint a little bit, you can see it says Stein, but you couldn't have made that out before. So that sort of began the process of narrowing down what we were looking for. And then, you know, all of us were all over, you know, the Internet, eBay, Google, you know, looking, okay, so who has Stein paintings? And they began to put this out in the various forms of media that they had, and they went to various places to try to find it. At one point, we did think that maybe, you know, my dream, frankly, was that this thing is hanging somewhere in somebody's house in Switzerland. And I felt confident that somehow, somewhere, somebody, you know, related to the family of this diplomat had this painting. And so they did collaborate with Swiss journalists about this, got this into the papers there. We had some hot leads in Switzerland. None of them panned out. none of those turned out to be right. And ultimately, they did identify this just through a search of who had bought and sold Otto Stein's paintings, and they came to this particular guy who had an interest in the artist.
And so where was it?
Well, you know, I don't know to this day the identity of the person who had it. It was a collector in Munich, and he was willing to talk to the team. He did not want to be publicly identified. The painting that he has was interesting in a lot of ways. The provenance on it, you know, sort of the art history of it, showed that it had turned up after the war and it had, quote, been damaged in the war. You know, we've looked at various things relating to how it's framed and how it's been preserved and so on and so forth. And it is clearly of the right age and subject matter and sort of general description of what we're looking for. And, you know, beyond that, and my father's sort of, and my father was a professor of comparative literature and English, a very, very careful, scholarly guy. And he did feel genuinely that this could be it. I was there when they showed it to him. They brought it from Germany all the way to Portland to show it to my dad, who had an amazingly good memory, and he was visibly moved by seeing it. And, you know, but as he wrote in an introduction to his own sort of beginnings of a memoir, which he never finished, you know, memory is a very tricky thing. You know, it's very hard to know what's a real memory, what's, you know. I will say this, though, about my father and his memory. In a number of instances in which he told us stories in the course of this investigation and told us things that he remembered, when we were able to find documentation of them, they were true. I mean, he remembered a terrible, terrible storm on the boat coming from Germany to America in January of 1939. And when we checked the records, there it was. There really was an amazingly powerful storm that time period that, you know, messed up all the shipping. So, I'm an agnostic. I'm a journalist. I'm like my dad. I'm kind of careful. So I wouldn't want to tell everybody that if you lay your eyes on that painting, you're seeing the one that we know 100% for sure. But it certainly seems plausible, perhaps even likely.
Well, Stephen, thank you so much. It's an amazing
story.
Thank
you. And I really appreciate the chance to share the story with you.
Absolutely. Stephen Engelberg is the editor of ProPublica. The Otto Stein paintings are on display at the Oregon Jewish Museum in Northwest Portland until February 4th. And that's our show today. Think Out Loud's production staff includes Julie Sabatier, Samantha Matsumoto, and senior producer Allison Frost. We get production assistance from Andrew Dorn. Zach Carver-Gustin and Nalene Silva engineer the show. Our technical director is Stephen Cray. The executive producer of Think Out Loud is Sage Van Wing. On Monday, we're going to talk to the Southern Poverty Law Center's Northwest correspondent, David Nywert. His new book, Alt America, chronicles the rise of the radical right from Ruby Ridge to the armed occupation of the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge and beyond. He'll be reading at Powell City of Books Sunday night at 7:30. If you don't want to miss any of our shows, you can listen to the NPR One app on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Our nightly rebroadcast is at 8 p.m. Thanks so much for tuning in. I'm Conrad Wilson. Have a great weekend.
Support for Think Out Loud is provided by the Rose E. Tucker Charitable Trust, Susan Hammer and Lee Kelly, and Ray and Marilyn Johnson.